once more for your attention. Just a few thoughts on not the ending, but the continuation of what we've been doing here, and how this may be carried into our worlds, into our families, work, the life outside of retreat, which is probably for most of us the largest part of our life. In fact, the notion of a retreat life and a life that is not retreat is in itself a little bit dangerous. I have come to appreciate that these things need to be woven together. We, all of us who are deeply engaged with the Dhamma teaching, are clear that this is something for life. It is not something for retreats. And the purpose of this, what we have been doing here, is that it helps in our lives, and that which comes from our lives is inevitable part of our practice, irrespective of our techniques, methods, or meditation strategies. Ultimately, it is life that is catching up with us. So let's try to be infectious. If good things have happened here, let's try to infect our lives with it. Let's try to be virulent in our lives with this Buddhism, with this contemplative practice. The word contemplative comes from the Latin, and it's something the old augurs used to do, the soothsayers in the Roman days. And they chose a particular area of the sky. We've just been looking at birds, I hoped to identify, so this is why this is off my head now. So these augurs, these soothsayers in Roman days, they would choose a particular area of sky which they would observe. And any movement of birds or whatever might fly through there was going to be given particular significance. So that's where the word contemplative comes from. It is somebody who has a designated area which he is particularly mindful of, and he's trying to identify the signs that are occurring in that area. I think that's maybe something quite useful to think of for a modern day samatha vipassana, satipatthana meditator. You know, looking for signs in that part in which I dedicate my awareness. So contemplative life can happen outside of retreats. The contemplative mind is a mind that we can strengthen, and a mind that we actually need to cultivate. It is not a mind that we are encouraged to cultivate by our societies. So it is something that takes clarity, that takes effort, and it takes some guts, to be honest with you. It takes a certain amount of audacity to say, yes, this is important, I'm going to give this part of my life, part of my day, to be concrete. If this is important, then my first great encouragement to carry this over into your lives is make some of your day over to this practice, to a space, a time, a place in which you go and sit with yourself as regularly as possible. Make sure that your environment knows that you're doing this and respects that space. And even more importantly, make sure that you respect that space, that you grant yourself the space to be with yourself. No list, no to-do lists, no yellow stickies, no phone calls. You don't need to justify meditation practice in terms of efficiency or gross national product. As long as you try to do that, it will not have the space. You instrumentalize it. But that's not the point. Contemplative space is where you are looking for signs. You're not trying to get things done more efficiently. So to have the courage to sacrifice some of one's time and some of one's day for this space, yeah, I like to think of it as a sacred space. I like to go through that rickety little door between past and future, go through that little door between those two huge big barn doors that stand for the past and the future, and take the little creaky door and go into the temple of suchness. How is it now? And be in there with myself. How is it to be with myself in this life? Some of the days your mind will be quiet, some of the time you will have insights, and some of the time you just go and listen how it sounds in there. You just go and listen. You look for the signs. So to give some of your day to that exercise, to that, you build that temple in your life. That is a good, a very powerful way of making this more real outside of retreats. That will take some courage, some discipline, it'll take some clarity. You will have to create boundaries around this. Whenever there is something beautiful or precious, you have to create boundaries. Otherwise, it'll be taken away, it will be soiled, it will be cramped with other things that want to take place. Complexity is an absolutely ubiquitous experience. We all struggle probably with this, and we need to defend this. So be clear that if you want this to happen in your lives, you need to make a decision. Not once, but many times, and you will need to defend this decision against many other things that suggest themselves to be now more important than your meditation practice. Long lists of such things, in fact, let alone intrusions from outside. So, my first recommendation, try to establish such a space in your lives. The second one is that insist that if anything is inspiring in spiritual teachings, that you insist that these teachings translate themselves into your life. Ask, what does that mean in my life? What does that mean in my relationship? What does that mean in my work? The things I know, the things I am conscious of, the things I have acquired an understanding of, what do they ask me? What do they ask of me? What is my responsibility? If I know these things, how should I live to be in accordance with my best knowledge? So, if you have an insight, if you have understanding, that doesn't come for free. It generally means you get more responsible. If you feel something, you become more responsible for what you feel. Yeah? If you feel things that are painful in others, you start to become more responsible for that. So understanding things is in a very dramatic way irreversible. Yeah? And that means we are called upon to act. We are called upon to manifest what we have understood. Not just to know it, but actually to manifest. That's another sign. See, so much about earthly life is manifestation. Manifesting Brahma Viharas, manifesting Samatha, manifesting understanding, manifesting skill in means, manifesting fathoming something deeply. Yeah, that's what Buddhist teaching asks us to do, is to make sure that we understand things as deep as is possible. So, the things I know in my life, what do they suggest I live like? What am I asked to change in my life, maybe? What am I asked to bring into my life? So ask yourself, what is the responsibility of your degree of consciousness in your daily life? Where your energies are going, your time, your money. Whom or what do you want to support with your energies, with your attention, with your time, with your money? So consider, are these things valid? Are these things deserving of your energies, your time, your attention, your money? If they are not, stop. Stop. Just stop. Give it somewhere else. Give it somewhere where it's worth it. So please make sure that Dhamma teachings, meditational teachings, are not something that stay on retreat, that happen in retreat centers and have nothing to do with the rest of your life. So insist that some crossover is happening. That is work, translating understanding into a practicable living wisdom is hard work. Translating Buddhist teachings that speak to us in strange Pali words and concepts we may find quite difficult to grapple with, translating this into our work and relational life is hard work. We need to find out what that means to us, what the thing relates to. We have learned in Pali language in my experience, and then we need to learn what that could mean for our experience, how it can change that experience. So please think about these things. Discuss them with people whom you feel of like mind, who share your inspiration. Be careful to discuss it with people who haven't been part of this experience. Be also careful to try to convince them more. People who know you well, they will be a lot less convinced by what you tell them than by what they see you have changed. Your most convincing missionary activity is if you manifest happiness, insight, wisdom, compassion. That's the great Buddhist soft sell. Yeah. If you go into a sort of evangelically missionary mode and try to convince people that really they should understand what anatta is and then their suffering would end, you really bash away at them. Generally, it doesn't produce very powerful results. Well, it does actually, but not in the way. So, it's what you live that is the best message. Seek out people, that's the third one. Seek out people. You see, there is something intensely relational. I touched on this last night, that what we practice here is not just something for our cushion. It is something that has to happen in our relationships, because we live so much of the time in relationship. So ask yourself how these things you have learned translate into your relationships. If you find people with whom you can practice, do so. Meet with others. Discuss things. Meditate together in groups. You have opportunities, maybe more than you think, because you haven't asked or you haven't looked around. There may be people not all too far from you who actually are quite into the same thing like you are. One of the great teachings of the Buddha is something called Kalyana Mitata, which means a noble friendship, beautiful friendship. And a Kalyana Mita, a noble friend, is somebody who is maybe something of a mentor or just a friend, somebody whom you trust in. It's not necessarily a teacher, it's not necessarily somebody who is perfectly enlightened. It is somebody with whom you share aspirations and who you respect for his dedication in this. You recognize in him something of yourself. So the Kalyana Mitta is the good friend who is accompanying you. And the Buddha speaks of a couple of qualities of a good friend. One of them is such a good friend inspires love, respect, and your wish to emulate such a person. You wish to become like this person. A good friend is somebody who can listen. A good friend is somebody who can give advice or counsel. He can help. Notice the difference, the sequence here. First he listens, then he gives advice. Some people mistake that. Quite willing to give advice, but their listening capacity seems to be somewhat impaired. So the good friend is somebody who listens and after deep listening can maybe offer something. A good friend is also somebody who is interested and capable in treating deep subjects. Yeah. That's not You know, this is not philosophy. It's not academic. Deep subjects are things that touch the life, that are existential in nature. So it's somebody who is in touch with the existential dimension of his or her life. And finally, a good friend is somebody who is looking out after my well-being. He looks that he does not, or she does not, lead me into wasting time, energy, money. So it's somebody who is actively caring for my spiritual and my otherwise well-being. So a good friend is a very precious thing to have in your life. And before you now complain that you don't have enough good friends, please consider not just who is your good friend, but consider also to whom you are such a good friend. Yeah. So this is a very touching and powerful channel we can share with other human beings. Usually our relationships are defined by similar background, by like and dislike, by sometimes by fate, being put together in a place and going through something together. It makes us grow close to someone. Good friendship in this sense I have just described is, it's a kind of a channel we choose. We try to choose relating to somebody on that level. We seek out that part in him that shares our aspiration. We can cultivate being with people like that. We can make ourselves available to be met on that level. Yeah. That is a very powerful teaching. The Buddha was quite clear that this was the largest part of what he felt was the monk's life about. When his clever disciple Ananda asked him and said, it seemed to him that half of the monastic, half of the holy, half of the brahmacharya life would be good friendship. The Buddha corrected him and said, no, no, Ananda, say not so. It is not half of that life. It is all of that life. Yeah. So this is a very powerful statement for the value of noble friendship in spiritual growth on the spiritual path. A big aspect in this is also consider that the implications of these four Brahma Viharas, namely that we are not isolated, that what happens to others is inevitably going to have an impact on our experience, that our experience, our happiness and our unhappiness cannot really be truly separated from other people's happiness and unhappiness. That urges us to act on the basis of compassion and solidarity for other human beings where we can. Yeah. It urges us to do things. This is not just a receptive quality. Understand, compassion is something, it's active. We do things to alleviate suffering where we can. We take demons out where they are in reach. So consider as a commitment for meditative practice to alleviate pain and help people to alleviate pain where you can. Suffering, frustration, a genuine solidarity which comes from an understanding that their happiness has something to do with our happiness. There is plenty of availability. You find teachings, teachers, retreats, courses. You will hear more about Tovana. You have more opportunities than probably the people who are our best teachers nowadays. Yeah, consider that. You are a Thai forest monk 50 years ago did not have radio, did not have TV, did not have MP3s, did not have, you know, multilingual Buddhist teachings, none of this. He would have a village temple, he would have a forest temple, he would have maybe one teacher who may be good or may be bad. Yeah. So consider the wealth that is at your disposal, and consider it's not a shame to have privileges, but it's necessary that we use them, really put them to use responsibly, openly. So, there are other things like, you know, if you find things we have done here useful, try to get some of this in your life. Some of the strengths of a retreat format comes through an ethical commitment. If ethical commitment is good in retreat, it may be good in your life. It creates safety, it creates boundaries, it creates clear responsibilities, it creates a care. If stillness is good, try to see whether you can somehow engineer more stillness in your life. If conscientiousness is good here, because so many people living together so closely, we all realize we have an impact on each other, then see whether you can carry some of the care and conscientiousness that has been in your relations with others here, that may have a powerful effect in your life. Being generous, consider the value of dana in your life, not just on meditation retreats. If you find, or if you want to find more teachings, you will know how to find them. So I wish you well, and thank you.